Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Dave and Danger Show, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. This is a show about independent and old-school pro wrestling, featuring current events, interviews, and whatever else they decide to talk about. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents the Dave and Danger Show with your hosts, Dave Wills and Mark Danger.
That's the way I feel when I get computer issues. Anyways, we're starting about 10 minutes too late for the David Daniel Show. We are here tonight. We do have Dennis Brent coming up very shortly. I do have on the line, he survived another year. I am Dave Wills. He is the Lemonade Con, Mark Danger. Welcome, Icon. How you doing, brother?
I am doing good. I'm doing better than Zsa Zsa Gabor's left leg. So.
Oh, that's disturbing. That's disturbing. Extremely disturbing. Ah, man, we do have one caller. We'll take a quick call before we get to this. Brent, 615 area code. You're on the Dave and Danger Show. Hello, Happy New Year. Hello. 615 area code. Going once, going twice, gone. Anyways, how you doing, Icon?
I am doing great. Before we do start the show and before Mr. Brent comes on, I'd like to wish a very special friend a happy birthday. And that is to
okay,
Mr. What?
Wish your special friend a happy birthday.
It's a happy birthday to to me, he's one of the Georgia wrestlers that I do enjoy watching, and it's worth a drive to go see him wherever he's at wrestling, is Mr. One and the Only Simon Sermon. And I want to wish him a happy birthday today.
Well, happy birthday to Simon Sermon, I tell you right there. Let's give him a round of applause, too. He deserves one. Simon Sermon, fantastic performer, fantastic wrestler. Definitely want to wish him a happy birthday. I figured it'd be Captain Kangaroo or Yoda or something. We're going to try it again. 615 area code. You're on the Dave and Danger Show. This is Dave and Danger. Hello. Caller, you're on the air. Caller, you're on the air. Well, okay. I guess the call don't have anything to speak of. That's okay. We're not taking this call anymore anyways. If you're going to call the David Danger Show, say something. You don't got to say much. Then we take Danger on the line. He says a bunch of silly things, and we lay him on the air. Danger, how's your holiday season, your Christmas?
Let's see. The Monday after Christmas wasn't pretty. But other than that, it was great. Got some nice gifts. I got to spend time with some great, wonderful family members. And enjoyed some snow.
Not good.
Or, like, snow outside, not, like, other snow.
Yeah, not like the nose candy that may have been used by 80s professional wrestlers. Anyways, got a lot going on this month. Going to have wrestling back in Stockbridge on the 15th. MGCW, MGCWnow.com has all the details on that. WWE4 wrestling is tomorrow in Atlanta, Commerce Drive behind Club Wax. WWE4.com has all the details on that. And I think it's LN Promotions has all the details. It's in February, but it's going to be... The Nightmare to Remember, the Ted Allen Tribute Show is going to be coming up then. So we definitely want to remind everybody about that in February. And I know we're going to want to do that. Let me try again and see what we got here. Caller, this is David Danger. You're on the air. Hello? Hello. Okay, let me see what. Oh, that may be our guest trying to call. I may have to try to get him a call myself here, which I think I will do right now. Our guest tonight is going to be Dennis Brent from, you may have heard of that name. He was one of the writers of the Stone Cold Truth with Jim Ross and Steve Austin. He was instrumental in WCW Magazine and WWF and WWE. He's worked behind the scenes in many promotions. We're going to be taking calls for Dennis Brent. We hope you would like to call in and ask questions about wrestlers. If we want to take as many questions as we can, if not, I got to run my mouth a lot and ask a lot of questions myself, which I normally do. So, what else do we got going on? GCW is no more down in Phoenix City. So, well, what can you do there? I'm going to try to get Taylor McKnight on coming up maybe in the next few weeks or so. Have him talk about that if he wants to comment.
But you also have replacing the GCW is, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but I think it's the Action Pro Wrestling Group. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, the Josh Wheeler Murder One Consortium that's running the shows over there.
Yep. Former, the brains of PWE, Pro Wrestling Evolution.
Sure, sure. Josh Wheeler's been a guest on this program before, and we'd love to have him on again. As a matter of fact, write that down, Icon. We'll just add a big, long list. Taylor McKnight, I want to get him on. I'm going to reach out to Josh Wheeler and see if he'd like to be on. I have a promoter who is going to be on next week. It's already confirmed. Stephen Platinum, who we had tried to get him before, but he was running shows at the Jungle. But Stephen Platinum will be on the show next week. So we're looking forward to that. He's made some controversial comments and apparently is doing some different things, and it's a new year. We want to see what he's up to. So I'm looking forward to talking to Mr. Platinum and find out more information. And I got a few other surprise guests coming up down the line, still working on that as well. So that's what's going on with the Dave and Danger show. Let me see here. I'll try to see if I can't, if perhaps our guest is available. I don't see, he hadn't called in yet, but what else is on your mind, Micah?
WWE
got the Miz as champ.
Yeah, see, so he's, from what I'm seeing, he's doing a good job. He's being restful with it. He is gaining a lot of respect from some interviews that I've seen. So he's not no slouch.
You like him as a champion better than John Cena, I see.
John Cena, like I said, I know WWE has pity on people and gives some people who ain't worth jobs, and I guess he just fit. I guess he's one of these, well, I ain't going to say that. I'd be bashing a good charity. But some people, they felt bad for him, so they're giving him a job. So
I don't think he's that bad, but we'll see. Anyways,
this is the thing. I would be willing to coat John Cena's bags.
I'm not surprised.
I'd be willing to tote his bags to the dumpster where they belong.
Well, you want to tote some bags, that's fine, Dandy. Let's see here. What else is going on? What else? We got any predictions for this year?
We'll have some celebrity deaths this year. I will go on record on this show that we will have a major, don't know if it's going to be from TNA or WWE. Don't know yet. I can't. My little crystal ball is kind of foggy right now. I just need to get some Windex and clean it. But I will go on record and predict there will be a major, major unfortunate death within one of the two companies.
Danger, you don't do that. Don't predict things like that. I thought you were predicting the guest or something. Okay, can you predict a positive thing? That's disturbing. That happens to people every day. Are you going to win the lotto this time?
I can only wish. I will go on record that I will satisfy many women this year once again.
Right. Okay. Probably by carrying their bags up the steps at your complex, about a guess.
No, think about it. Who doesn't want to be with a true legend? A hardcore legend.
Yeah, but why do they want to be with you if they want to be with a hardcore legend?
Because when I thrust, I do the danger pose. So.
Yeah. You're just ready for this new year, ain't you?
Well, I am ready for this new year. It's going to come out a bang, so.
But everybody's loving you this weekend. Oh, well.
Yeah, some people.
Let me see what we got. Some people probably hating your guts, but that's okay, Icon. As long as I got a show, you can have a little employment here and everything. I'll make it easy like that. Here, let me see here. We're going to try to see if we can call in there. Okay. What else is going on, Icon?
Pretty much, you got Genesis coming up. I know you saw a preview flashed up on TV, so that'll be a pay-per-view that nobody really cares about. You had the Japanese Super Show.
Hold on a second here. I think this may be our guest. Hello. Thanks for calling Dave in Danger. Hello. Hello. Caller.
Yes.
Who am I speaking with? This is the David Danger Show. Who is this? I don't know who they're looking for. Anyways, we're going to take a quick break right here. And no, we're not. We got our guest here. Hold on a second here. I'm about to bring on our guest right now. This man is a...
David.
Hey, Dennis, how are you, sir?
Doing, Dave? Okay.
Very good. Thanks for calling. Let me give you a proper build-up here. I want to tell you our guest tonight is a well-known author who has been in the wrestling business for many years as well. He is... If you remember going to the NWA or WCW and seeing the wrestling wrap-up or some of the other publications, you saw this man's work. Also in WWE, he not only took care of some of the publications they had, but also assisted in the developmental program. And his time in wrestling dates all the way back to World Class in the UWF.
Yeah.
Or is that farther there? Is it even farther?
To 1984, 25 years, basically.
25 years. Ladies and gentlemen, here he is, Dennis Brent.
Boy, you all have a huge crowd here, David.
Yeah, tell me about it. we flew an audience just for you. I'll tell you right now, I was going to say, what a resume, what a background in the wrestling business. Tell me, I was going to say, what was it like going from, starting 84, 25 years in the wrestling business? What was it like working in so many different promotions for so long, meeting so many different people?
It was really just a dream. I mean, I started out as, like everybody else, just a fan watching on TV, and by pushing myself and good timing and meeting up with the right folks at the right time, got into World Class, which led to UWF, which led to NWA, which led to WCW, which led to WWF. So it was like a roller coaster ride up and down, good times and bad times. So it was a lot of fun.
I was going to say that I'm sure you worked with and met so many different wrestlers because you were there for so many different boom times, from world classes, boom period, to UWF and on. Do you have a certain time period or a place where you were, let's say, at the right time, the synchronicity, that you really just got a huge kick out of being a part of?
Well, I really enjoyed the UWF. It's one of my most favorite associations because that was real pro wrestling the way it should be done. But NWA in its time was fantastic. But the thing that to me was the biggest kick was I got to WWF just as the Attitude Era was starting and got to experience that. I got there just as Stone Cold was going to wrestle Mike Tyson at WrestleMania, and it set that whole thing going and was all the way till Steve had his second match with The Rock at WrestleMania, and then The Rock went off to Hollywood. So that, you know, that was like the full serving of it, which was the best. You know, working with The Rock and Steve and Big Show and Hunter up there is wonderful.
What an exciting time to be a fan of wrestling. I can't imagine working in it, seeing the WWF come aboard with WrestleMania and the territory still being strong from the mid-80s up till around 87, 88, and then seeing working for the number two competitor, the number one competitor, WWE, and then getting the WWE, that had to be something else. Just wonder, how did you get into pro wrestling, Dennis?
I was basically a fan. I had a computer software publishing company, and we published software that fortunately Radio Shack marketed for us. And I was getting some software manuals printed and was at the printer, and at the printer was Percy Pringle picking up World Classes programs that night. So I started talking about Percy, about the programs, and that I had the facilities to maybe produce those at a better price than he was having them done. So we gave that a shot, and all of a sudden I was doing programs for World Class and pretended like I knew how to be a photographer and got myself a 35-millimeter camera and got someone who was a photographer to show me what to do, and all of a sudden I was taking pictures at ringside. The first night I was there, Abdullah the Butcher was in, and I didn't trust him. I didn't know what was real and what wasn't, and he took a Japanese photographer by the back of his head and slammed him into the mat and busted his camera into pieces. So I definitely stayed on the other side of the ring from Abdullah that night because I didn't really know what was going on.
I was going to say, if Abdullah, everything's real. If he's in front of a crowd, run. Run. I don't care if you're a commissioner, an announcer, run, and run hard. I certainly did, I tell you right there.
When Abby's in the ring, he is his character. He is Abdullah. Sure. But in WCW, we should do a thing that at TV tapings, that when they go to commercial and the cameras would be turned off and I was still at ringside and he was getting ready to go back to the locker room, we'd do a thing where he would chase me with his kendo stick and I would run, you know, in fear. Of course, I was really running, but I knew he wasn't going to hurt me. But, you know, the fans on the front row always got a kick out of it and were laughing, you know, that this idiot photographer was going to get killed by Abdullah the Butcher.
But I'll tell you right now, you don't see that as much nowadays. You don't see a lot of characters like, okay, obviously Abdullah, he's got a restaurant in Atlanta. He's a very successful businessman. He obviously has investors. I've had a conversation with Abdullah, multiple people have. Obviously, he's not a Sudanese madman. But you don't really see a lot of characters. If I did not know and had a conversation when I was a kid, I believe this man could be some kind of nut. Well,
right.
Why do you think we don't see that? Is it just that so many other things have came out, or lack of kayfabe? What would you say with people?
that's not what Vince wants. I mean, everybody had a name like Hot Stuff, Eddie Gilbert, Abdullah the Butcher. I mean, everybody had some kind of name, you know, that described their character, and now it's just first and last name, like a John Cena or a Randy Orton or whatever. And Undertaker's one of the few remaining gimmicks that, you know, sticks to his gimmick. You know, Vince evidently wants, you know, all his wrestlers basically are like action figures, and he wants, you know, toys that'll sell, although I think if he had some monsters mixed in there, they would sell well, too.
Well, to be honest, what's old is new again, I would consider, because a lot of people who haven't seen a lot of the wrestling back from then, I think that, now granted, I understand for certain reasons he probably couldn't go that far with the blood, of course, but to have some, you know, wild monster or something who protects his character, I think, hey, you know, what do you got to lose, you know? Like you said, Undertaker may be the last guy, and he actually does a great job of keeping his character completed.
Even without blood, if a monster came in and there were some new kids in the ring, like from NXT or whatever, and this new monster beat the heck out of three of them and left them laying, not able to get up and move, that would definitely get people to tune in the following week to see what the heck's going to happen. But in the old days to get heat.
I would say that you're probably right about that, definitely.
In the old days definitely. To get heat on a good guy or a new kid, they would have somebody like an Abdullah the Butcher come in and catch him and leave him in a pool of blood, and that would get the whole program started. So,
sure.
You know, that's an element we don't have anymore, but that was definitely a part of the business.
Absolutely. Working in world class, I'm sure after your first meeting with Abdul and Brody, you may got to have, you know, got to know him a little better. What was Abdul like away from the ring, and what
in
was
world,
he doing important?
In world class back then, I respected everybody's gimmick and didn't really talk to them about their personal life because I was just breaking in. I didn't ask questions. Basically, you were supposed to just sit there and absorb and watch. And it wasn't until the UWF that I started getting friendly with talent. And in WCW one time, coming back from an event, back then you could upgrade to first class on Eastern Airlines for just $10. So maybe that's why they're out of business. But one time I'd upgraded to first class and happened to get a seat right next to Abdullah the Butcher. And so that we were talking, and as we're getting close to Atlanta, he asked what kind of car I had, and so I told him. So he asked if I could give him a ride home. So I said, sure, I'd be happy to, and drove him to his house, and he invited me in, and we had some iced tea, and around his house, and he showed me a bunch of pictures, and we were good friends after that. And in fact, we used to have lunch together about once a week in Atlanta at some restaurant or another, which to me was a thrill, and I'm sure we looked like Mutt and Jeff are a real freak because, you know, he's huge, obviously, and I'm 5'6", 240 pounds, and he was, I don't know, 300 or 350, and Abdullah the Butcher. But he was a real gentleman and a wonderful person outside the ring. And as a photographer, he always would do special things for me, as far as, you know, making sure that I got to take pictures of the brutality that he was doing. He would put a guy right in front of me and stretch his mouth open or stick a fork in his head or something so I could get a picture.
Nice. No, and you're definitely right about that Abdullah's restaurant. That's one heck of a place to go. If you hadn't visited, get to Atlanta, go there. It's fantastic.
When Abby first opened, I was in one of his TV commercials.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what was that like?
Joe Pedicino was the filmer for it. He had a little sideline business where he did commercials, and so he shot this one at Abdullah's work. I'm innocently sitting at a booth eating barbecue, and Bonnie and a couple other guys are at a table across from me, and they're eating ribs, and in comes Abdullah the butcher, and he spots the ribs, and he reaches over their table and takes a rib and starts eating it, and you know, and then throws the bone over his head and walks away like he's an animal, and I'm just sitting there looking like, what the heck is going on? So that was a commercial.
Fantastic, fantastic. Did you get to know the Von Erichs? I'm sure you said you mentioned Percy Pringle. I know he was with The Office at the time, of World Class. Did you have a lot of dealings with Fritz Von Erich as well?
I did. Got to know Fritz, went to his ranch in East Texas several times and conferred with him on the magazine numerous times, and a lot of times Carrie and Kevin and Mike and sometimes Chris was there, and we talked about a lot of things. And about the same time, UWF was starting to come to Dallas to compete with them, and the Freebirds and Precious and other talent from World Class was up there. So they were kind of enemies, and my magazine, I was independent. I was covering both of them because I was supposedly doing the best of Texas wrestling, and Fritz told me that I had to make a choice, either World Class or UWF, and that was about 6 months after I was doing both of them, and so I went with UWF because it just seemed to me that that was the future, because I saw World Class was going to be having some problems.
What's your thoughts nowadays, too, about if you see all that went on with World Class and how instead of being remembered for the wrestling, it's now remembered for a lot of deaths that happened?
It's really sad. The whole time I was there, I never saw any wrestlers doing any drugs. There was a liquor store across from the Sportatorium, and I would see guys walk over there and come back with a bottle of Jack Daniels or whatever, including David Von Erich, but never saw anybody doing anything. So, but evidently, you know, there was stuff going on, and several guys tried to clue Fritz in on it, but he didn't want to listen, and that was probably the problem because he didn't want to handle it. But it was really sad when I was driving, when we heard on the radio that David Von Erich had died in Japan, and I had to pull over on the side of the road because I just couldn't believe it. And then not that long after that was Gino Hernandez and, you know, and then Bruiser Brody, and, you know, just kept going on, you know, and
so many more, and Terry Gordy, Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer, Mr. Jeep Swinson, and Chris Adams.
And then WWF kept going on and on. There's probably at least 50 names that I knew that aren't here with us anymore.
Did you see a lot of the part? Do you think that the party atmosphere contributed? I mean, why do you feel that it was just so that, I guess, some of this, people call them demons, overindulging in, you know, whatever.
I never did it in my life, but it seems to me that the root of most of this was cocaine, and that, I guess, originated as a party-type thing. But then in the 90s, when WWF, it turned out to be more painkillers, so the guys were working a lot, and they were doing the somas to get past their injuries and keep working. And it was not good. In the old days, if you didn't work, you didn't get paid. In the WWF, you got paid whether you were hurt, whether you were working or not, but you didn't want to have them leave you off of TV for 2 or 3 weeks because you were injured. So they would.
Did you have anybody in, let's say, World Class or UWF when you were starting out who kind of, I don't want to say kayfabe you, but kind of, you know, kind of try to severely keep their distance, or, you know, seem kind of, you know, got a, you know, a little bit, you know, staying back away from you? And was there anybody who actually reached out his hand other than Percy and some others?
Kerry Taylor and Eddie Gilbert were very open and helpful to me and basically smartened me up on a lot of things. And Bruiser Brody never broke kayfabe. You know, I when I was in the same room with him, I really didn't start a conversation or anything because I believed his character was, you know, him. I mean, I didn't know what was real and what wasn't, but I knew he was a big, bad machine. And so I didn't bother
sure.
Frank. You know, Kevin and Kerry were friendly. The funny thing about Kevin is that half the time he couldn't remember who I was, or he'd say hi to me earlier in the evening, and then a half hour later he'd see me like he hadn't seen me at all that night, and that's because that was recently after he'd had a concussion. He had a problem with his brain bouncing around in his head, and he would have these concussions, give himself a concussion. But most people were pretty open. Guys like Buzz Sawyer, I kind of left to their own because they didn't really need me bothering them, and they had their own agendas. You know, Buzz was a really good character and a good wrestler, but
sure.
Had problems. One time at the Sportatorium, they were surrounded by police cars, and all the guys were talking about, what is the police here for? And it was a real deal. The police surrounded the building to take a hold of Buzz because of child support payments that he was overdue on. And so that was one of the things that the Sportatorium, that would never happen at WCW or WWF. But, you know, back in the indie days, that stuff happened, I'm sure, all the time.
Sure. Sure. Just one, and being in your world class in UWF, any stories, a guy I used to love to watch was Iceman Parsons, and while he may not have been the greatest wrestler, the character was interesting, the missing link. Any stories about either one of those two guys?
Link is another guy that I was friendly with and would say hello to, but was a guy that I never expected to break kayfabe because it just didn't seem like he wanted to. Like, his wife would be his manager or whatever, and they would, you know, like at a hotel or something, I'd see him walk into their room or up in the elevator or whatever, but he was always doing his gimmick, you know, so I never talked to him like a real person. Iceman, you could talk to. He was a good guy. I don't know why he never progressed past UWF into NWA or WCW, but it be that way sometimes.
Phenomenal talent. I love Iceman Parsons' interviews. I guess I'll...
In world class, he was really very over. But I think what kind of killed him off in that territory is when he turned heel and joined the Freebirds and was called the Blackbird. And
the Blackbird.
Fans kind of quit liking him at that point. He was the first black heavyweight champion before Ron Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
But evidently, they don't consider the world class title a real world title. But he was the champion.
That's what they say. As a matter of fact, you make a good point. Back in the of Napolitano, where it was just your magazine guy. We'll talk about the magazines. I know for fans who may not remember the magazine, they had the after books, as they were called, the PWIs, the Instant Wrestling, the Wrestler, Sports Review Wrestling, 500 wrestling magazines, and after was pretty much the face, but was the face of them, and he was the photographer on there. And then George Napolitano had some magazines, but back then they would have the discussions in the magazines like, you know, who is the real world champion? Should the world class or UWF title be elevated to world championship status? And now belts are taken for a joke.
They didn't really have anything to write about because they couldn't write about the real stuff. You know, they didn't break kayfabe. They follow the storylines, and so they would come up with stories like that just to generate interest in people buying the book so they could put on the cover, you know, who's the real world champion. I even did that when I was covering both UWF and WCW because Kevin had just won the world-class title, and Dr. Death had just won the UWF title, and so I put both of their, it was Ric Flair and Kevin, and so I put their both of their pictures on and said that they were both world champions, so who's the real world champion? You know, and so you did that kind of thing just to do something interesting, but obviously Flair was the real world champion.
But the interesting thing is, being that titles used to be so much of a part of wrestling where you could actually, you know, where fans would debate, hey, WWE, Hulk Hogan is the champion. He defends his better in the world. Ric Flair takes some tougher guys. Barry Windham's a lot tougher than Big John Studd or Bundy, you know. Well, Flair's this. You don't hear anybody doing that with WWE or SmackDown or Raw or TNA or any of that stuff.
WWE titles don't mean anything. I mean, it changes so much that whoever wears it, it doesn't even mean anything, because in the old days, it usually meant that the guy made more money because of the belt, or he was more liked by the fans, or that they needed to boost business by having the heel cheat and screw the good guy out of the title, which would generate interest. But, you know, these personal issues aren't what they base things on anymore. And so, really the title, and, you know, title that means.
I was going to say, do you feel by de-emphasizing the belt, the belts, that it's hurt the ability for wrestling, it's cut off an avenue for them to draw?
Definitely. You know, when they had the top 10, that was something that the fans could identify with. And made sense that, you know, who was number one in line for the title, who was number five in line for the title, and what they would have to do to go up the ladder, or who they would have to wrestle and beat to be up. And it all made sense, you know, by having the top 10 and, you know, on the road to who was the title holder made sense.
Sure.
But,
most
you know, when
now, go ahead.
When World Class broke out of NWA and formed their own association, and everybody was cheering and complimenting them, and they were acting like it was such a good deal, I was thinking, that's not a good deal because we're not going to see Ric Flair anymore.
And Flair would bring people in quite a bit.
So the first champion was Black Bart, nothing against Bart, and then he lost the title to Rick Rude, and you know, that was their first few champions. But to me, that meant nothing compared to Ric Flair coming in and defending the title.
Well, I like Black Bart, but no. Black Bart doesn't put as many people in the seats as Ric Flair. I think we all can agree on that.
Yeah. Plus, definitely. You know, the fans, even though they weren't, quote, smart, they knew that in a match with Black Bart against Ric Flair, what would happen. Bart would do a good job, but they would both leave the match bloody, and Flair would have the belt over his shoulder.
Certainly. UWF, what was it like? Were you there when Fritz was Watts looking to expand nationally, or had his business already tanked when you came in there, or was he at the peak? Where was business at?
It was still doing really good, and he was even starting to expand his territory. He was starting to do some shows up in the on the east and the northeast outside his territory. I think he did a show in Philadelphia. It was, you know, draining his money, and it wasn't working. You know, it was good for maybe a one-time deal, but it wasn't something you could do all. And I didn't know it at the time, but he was spending more than he was making, and a lot of the guys had jumped to WWF, like Duggan and DiBiase, and you know, things were starting to not look that good. You know, Watts was, it took over Kansas City and Florida. I mean, Vince had taken over Kansas City and Florida and different places and closing down the territories. And, you know, so we could see the writing on the wall. So when Bill sold to Crockett, it looked like that might be something that might work. And I was lucky enough to go work for Crockett and go to some of those final Starcades and pay-per-views up in the East Coast and see the shows that they tried to compete with Vince on. But we couldn't get good buildings. You know, we couldn't, obviously couldn't Garden, and the closest we could get to New York City was the Meadowlands. And January 11th, whatever year it was, that Flair won the title up at the Meadowlands, there was only probably 2,000 or 3,000 people there because it had a tremendous snowstorm that day. So it was, you know, it was a great event that almost nobody saw.
Being in the UWF, any memories of matches or any memories of the guys competing, stuff that you really were proud to be a part of in the UWF, match?
Any of the stuff with Eddie Gilbert was memorable because he was a genius, and the stuff that, I mean, he was, if he wasn't a booker, he helped Watts with the storylines, and Hot Stuff International with Sting and Steiner, and, you know, and then when Sting turned against Eddie, it was just fantastic storylines. You know, and then the stuff with Missy and John Tatum and Eddie, and, you know, they just constantly had stories that made sense that would, the storyline would go 3 to 6 months or whatever.
Why didn't they ever really put Eddie Gilbert and Tatum in a feud? Was it because of the personal issue, or because you expect the long, drawn-out feud? And you had like a couple of matches, and that was about it.
Yeah, probably because personal stuff. I mean, because there was a real situation behind it that if they really wanted to, they would be in a really bad fight. And so they were being gentlemen and having matches without really crap out of each other. But basically, you know, Eddie did take Missy away from John. So.
The other thing I was thinking about possibly is because, I mean, it would be real hard to have a really big face coming out of that because, I mean, Hollywood John Tatum is definitely not the one that everybody's going to get behind just because he's
right.
Not. I mean, he's got that bionic pout that's just fantastic. But
and Eddie was not a fan favorite either, but
he was leading the heel organization that was for the tag titles. So
as a storyline, it's, you know, back in the days, the thing that sold tickets was personal issues that people I could identify with. So a guy taking another guy's girlfriend or wife was a personal issue, whether they were a good guy or a bad guy.
Sure.
Oh.
Sure, I definitely can see that. Why do you think that Crockett did not do a promotion versus promotion feud with UWF to make some money?
Because he was a fool. He totally botched that whole thing major. In fact, the very first Starcade was a combined NWA-UWF group that was in Chi-Town Heat or Chi-Town Rumble, whatever it was.
Chi-Town Heat, yeah.
Right. And
yeah,
so
yeah,
it was
Chi-Town Heat 87.
Yeah, that was my first NWA pay-per-view, and I was going to be able to shoot ringside. And, I flew up there really excited. And since I felt I was representing the UWF, or at least as my character, a really neat UWF jacket, figured if I wore it ringside, it would make the UWF look good, that they had their own magazine there. And before the show started, Jim Crockett said, "What are you wearing?" I said, "My UWF jacket." And he goes, "You're not going to wear that at ringside." And I said, "Why?" And I explained to him my reason, that it would make it look real and cool that the UWF was here covering their guys. And he goes, "Nope, I don't want to see it on TV. If I see it there, then I'll have security pull you out." So I took it off and put it away.
Wow.
And that, if you remember on that show, every single UWF guy got beat other than Sting.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Do you feel that rumors, people have said that perhaps Dusty Rhodes had put some of the kibosh on that? Do you feel that was the case? Do you feel it was mostly Rocket?
Without knowing, I feel that that's probably true. Dusty, I mean, I think Dusty was one of the reasons that Crockett ran out of money and tanked, because Dusty was booking for himself and not for business. I mean,
so you're saying Dusty Rhodes facing both Road Warriors might have been more for Dusty than for what the fans wanted.
Dusty put himself in, or anybody that was over, the thing with Nikita, anybody popular, Dusty would be his tag partner. Because Dusty thought that he was the guy who was selling the tickets. But
then he had him and Sting against the Warriors, too.
Plus his, you know, the term Dusty finishes didn't come from nowhere. You know, many referee bumps, too many disqualifications. You know, people got tired of seeing that same stuff over and over. So that's what killed Dusty's booking, and that's probably what killed a lot of Jim Herd's business was Dusty.
Do you feel that the Warriors were hurt by the fact that they did not, I know they're both from Minnesota, but in their gimmick hometown of Chicago, bring the belts home from the Horsemen that night?
I was there, and it was just the biggest thing. I mean, the fans were just booing their heads off, and it made absolutely no sense. Me and George were looking at each other and talking about it. We just couldn't believe it, that a DQ finish with the Warriors not winning in Chicago. It made no sense at all. And what would it have hurt for them to get the win? Nothing.
No.
Made
no absolutely not. Was anybody in WCW, you know, helpful? How did you wind up... You left UWF, you're in NWA Crockett now. How did you wind up getting involved in stuff like the Wrestling Wrap-Up, or was that the magazine, or was there one before that for Crockett?
Oh, that was their first magazine. A guy named Rob Garner, who was Crockett's marketing guy, had come and visited UWF several times, talked to Watts about business, going to go. So I introduced myself to Rob and told him what I did and that I'd like to do the same thing for the NWA. He explained me to Crockett back in Charlotte, and I got the job. You know, they liked what I did, and they didn't have their own magazine. So they had, you know, I did a magazine and programs for them, which was a lot of fun, because all of a sudden it was, to me, the major league. I had no interest in the WWF because NWA to me was real wrestling, the top of wrestling, and WWF was cartoons. But
sure.
So, you know,
that's the consensus. I was going to say that's the consensus of a lot of people from the Southeast,
The way I got to WCW was the same thing, that when Turner bought it, I went to one of the tapings after Turner owned it, and where Herd was going to be there. And Terry and Michael Hayes pointed out who Jim Herd was at the bar, and I went up and talked to Herd and told him what I did, and he let me come to Atlanta a week or two later and talk more to him about it. And so I did it from Dallas for a month or two, going to Atlanta a couple times a month, taking pictures, putting stories together. And after 2 or 3 months, he told me, "Look, you're going to have to relocate to Atlanta if you want to keep doing this." So I said, "Okay."
And here comes the moving truck. Hey, Danger, you got any questions for Dennis Brent? So far, we're covering a lot of stuff fast. What you got?
Yeah, talking about World Class, I saw a story that you got something, Brent Spiner gave you something that not too many people got, was a Zippo cigarette lighter. Can you explain anything about that?
Well, Fritz was a chimney. He smoked quite a bit. And after my meeting with him at the ranch, where we talked about the magazine and what I would be doing for him and his boys in World Class, and we had a lunch and Bronco Lubitsch and David Manning and Kevin were there, and everything went fine, and as we were leaving, he reached in his pocket and took out this Zippo lighter that was brand new in a little box, you know, a Zippo box, and he says, "I only give these to special people. Here you go." And I was just thrilled with it. I still have it, and have a picture on my Facebook page. I mean, it's one of the coolest things I have. It says, "Taken by Force from Fritz von Erich." And, I mean, it's really classic. Even Jim Ross says he's never seen one. I doubt that Watts has one.
I bet not. And everything. Well, why are you talking about? I was going to say, he's talking about going back to world class. Your memories of Bronco Lubitsch? He was a slow ref, but I just, for some reason, I got the biggest kick out of Bronco Lubitsch growing up watching him referee a match.
Bronco was a great guy, and he was slow because of his age. But and the photographers, we would joke that, you know, because, you know, we wanted to be ready for the finish of the match, so we would get the 1-2-3. But we knew amongst ourselves, unless Bronco got down on his hands and knees to count, that it really wasn't going to be the finish. That if he really got down and to count, then it was going to be the finish. So,
it's like Rebirth Jones putting a pin in his mouth at center stage. Oh, boy.
And the way they do it at WCW is that Gene Anderson would come out and fluff his tie a little bit, and that would be a signal to the ref and the wrestlers that it was time to go home. And the fans at the Omni started recognizing every time they saw this old guy come out and fluff his tie that something was going to happen. So he started coming out at different exits to do it, and so they had to come up with something different after a while. But it was always Gene Anderson that came out and played with his tie, which was the signal.
I thought for a while at WCW they had Rhubarb Jones take off his, or put a pin in his mouth, too. I thought they had that as a signal for a while as well.
That could have been. I mean, I remember something about a pin in the mouth, but I don't know if it was Rhubarb or what, because Rhubarb wasn't a booker. But
he was ring announcer at the time.
Right. So maybe,
I think they
had
to change that. I was going to say they had to change that too, because people started popping when the pin goes in the mouth. Yay!
Right. But I do remember something about the pin in the mouth, yeah.
Going back to UWF. What was Bill Watts like? How was he as a business? You dealing with him one on one in business and also in wrestling. How did Bill Watts treat you?
Bill treated me pretty good. He treated me fair, and there wasn't really anybody in his company that was doing what I did, so he kind of gave me free hand, and I really wasn't charging. I didn't work for him officially. I was providing the service of doing the programs and doing a magazine in exchange for him letting me take pictures and sell the programs and the magazines there, which I would make money on, or some money, and so it was that kind of deal. He didn't pay me, but he gave me access and let me do these things and let me call it the official UWF publication. So, you know, all the guys in the back paid attention since I was the, quote, official publication, and I got lots of interviews and pictures and whatever. Everything went according to storyline. You know, nothing was true, you know, real life, but it was great. It was fun.
Sure.
Bill was always good. And Jim Ross.
I was going to say, it was in the boom period of time. If you don't mind me asking, what could you end up making on programs and photos in a night or a week or something like that, some of his bigger shows at that time?
I don't really remember for sure, but I know sometimes out on the road at towns like in Birmingham, Alabama, or in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, sometimes we'll sell several thousand dollars worth of merchandise.
Really?
From the table, because people wanted a souvenir of some sort. And, you know, I did come out with some T-shirts and some headbands or arm wristbands that he said was okay. And I did give a little, I did give a check to the wrestlers, you know, of their share. One time I went up to Barry Windham with a check for $40. And he goes, "What's this for?" I said, "Well, that's your cut for headbands." He goes, "I didn't know we were getting paid for these." He goes, "Bill never paid us for these." So I said, "Well, I will."
Uh-oh. There you go, stooging up the boss. Danger, what else you got?
It's just, were there anybody that you just wanted to interview and you just never had the opportunity to? With just how people back then, how, say, the doors were revolving with talent coming in and going out. Was there anybody that you kind of wanted to interview but just never had a chance?
Good question.
One that I knew from ringside and we would say hello to back and forth, but I never got a chance to interview, was Terry Funk. I always wanted to. But Terry, you know, was a heel and his gimmick, he didn't sit down and talk about things and for reality or for his character, so I never really bothered him for it. But he would always pose for pictures, no problem.
I see. Oh, anything else, Dave?
That's better for right now.
Not for now. All right. You're in the WCW. You're working for Turner. What's your thoughts of you know, like you said, you're in the major leagues for your wrestling and stuff like that, where you know when people are doing wrestling and all. How exactly is everything going with Herd and everything and the magazine? You know, does it take off like you like, or how was your first start? I guess your first time starting up over there.
The magazine sold fine for what it was. Turner had his own art department, and so they designed the magazine, and I would go down and work with them to create the issue each month. But it was costing a lot of money, and finally the Turner accounting department said, "You got to find a different way to do this." And so we had to reduce some pages for a while or not to use 6 colors and use 4 colors. And eventually, London Publishing and the old guy that used to own it made an offer to Herd that, "Hell, we can publish your magazine." And so they took over and has been called WCW Magazine. I was still the editor, but Craig Peters was the overall editor. He wasn't my boss, but I had to work with him as far as dates and what they wanted and so forth, their deadlines, and it wasn't, you know, in their stories, they put in their own stories, and, you know, I'm not going to, I wasn't really crazy about all their stuff because it was the PWI kind of stuff and not the kind of stuff I would do, but I would always get the first 4 pages to do my own stuff. So, you know, that the wrestlers would come to me and tell me the kind of stuff that they wanted in the magazine.
Compare and contrast what PWI was doing and what you were doing, because there definitely were differences, but I think you could explain it better than I, the differences between the PWI versions of the magazines and between, you know, what you were putting out at the time.
I considered mine a semi-shoot in that I would talk about the guy's personal or family issues as it related to the business, you know, if it was okay to talk about that they had kids or just had a new baby or something about their family, then I would do it. And if it went against their character, I wouldn't. Or we would, you know, go beyond storylines, like, you know, do stories about, like, Sting at the gym or... When Sting first started, I did a Shane Douglas. When Shane Douglas first started, I did a full interview with him, and it was his first interview, and he really didn't know what to say. And Eddie Gilbert was in the room, and Eddie, it was funny because it wasn't on videotape, but I'd ask a question, and Shane would look at Eddie, and Eddie would tell him what to say, and Shane would answer. And it's funny because Shane really didn't have to say anything. Eddie could have just said it. But we did produced what Bill would have wanted it to say, because Eddie knew.
Yeah, you actually did legit interviews, even though it may have been coached. They were legit interviews with words coming out of their mouth. I know that.
I had real interviews with Jim Ross and with Sting, and when Paul Lee first came in, I had a very long real interview with him, and Paul knew what to say and what not to say. You know, we didn't necessarily break kayfabe, but Paul was always on the edge of it. And so, you know, the magazine, my magazines were not there to insult the intelligence of the fans. I wanted it to be where if they understood or can read between the lines, they would know, but not to just treat them like they're idiots and don't know anything.
Sure. Paul Heyman, a lot's been said about the man who later would book ECW, who would go to WWE, who's now managing one of the baddest men on the planet, Brock Lesnar, in UFC as a shoot, not as a ringside guy, and he's also writing a book. Paul Heyman.
In his own right, Paul is a genius, too. I interviewed him toward the end for Steve Austin's book, and Paul, had a lot of interesting things to say. ECW is where Steve first learned how to be a wise-ass big mouth, and Paul's the one who taught him how to do that, and that was, one of the things that convinced Vince that Steve could do this, and with Brock, I'm sure they're going to do big things. I heard Brock may be at WrestleMania, which Vince would love. And it'd be fun for everybody if Brock came in and did that. When I was in charge of developmental, Brock was just a learning student at OVW. Although he was a collegiate wrestling champion at OVW, he was a student. And he was a student that was in a hurry because he knew he could wrestle. And he didn't like sitting there and learning how to do arm bars and wrist locks and things like that. And was anxious to come up to Raw and start doing his thing. And I guess once he started doing it, he didn't really enjoy it because he wanted to fight people for real and not follow a storyline.
Certainly. You mentioned in developmental, take me to where you go, to where you come from, being in WCW, writing for the London Publishing Group. How did you move over to WWE, and how did you get involved in developmental?
I quit WCW as Eric and was taking over. His little trio of power was Ole Anderson and Ole's girlfriend, who I'm not going to say her name, but she was somebody in WCW who turned out to be a real nothing that ended up suing Turner for $100,000 because of something that supposedly Eric had done, and she won. And so that just shows Eric, he shouldn't have done anything with her, but she was the reason that I quit. They took my office away. Ole took my office. She wanted me to work out of a cubicle and be there 9 to 5, and that just isn't what I went there to do. And so I did the hotline for a while, and then when Eric took fully over, and JR, I quit the day after JR quit because I just couldn't see that I was going to enjoy this job at all. And went to work with Nolan Ryan, the baseball Hall of Famer, and was still in Atlanta, but was doing a publication for Nolan's charity foundation that turned out real well and did a website for Nolan, and then and kept in touch with Jim Ross. And when he got fired the second time by Vince and moved back to Atlanta, Jim and I got closer and we started doing stuff with Smoky Mountain. And then he got called back to WWF, and he put some words in for me, and I finally got a call to come up there and do an interview. That was probably in 1998, and I left WCW in 1994, so I was 4 years out of business. Mm-hmm. Although I was doing stuff with Smoky Mountain in between.
I was going to say, I asked you about Pauly Dangerously. A lot of people have a lot of opinions on him, and a lot of people have a lot of opinions on Jim Cornette. Your thoughts on James E.?
Jimmy, I always call him Corny, is an absolute genius. He believes in the pro wrestling business the way it should be and the way it's been done for the last 50 or 75 years. The students in Louisville, he had a book that he would photocopy and give them that had like 50 or 75 pages of wrestling history, you know, from like Alabama and Deep South wrestling, of how, what things happen and storylines and whatever. So he wanted them to understand how it's supposed to work. And the newer guys were complaining to Vince that this is all BS because they're not going to need this in WWE. And why did they have to do this stuff? And eventually that's why WWF let OVW go and fired Cornette and Danny Davis, because some of the guys, or a couple of them, were complaining that they're wasting their time there. Although the stars that came out of OVW were like Batista, John Cena.
Kurt Angle?
Yeah, Kurt Angle's brother was there, and unfortunately he got injured, or he would have been a good guy. Whenever somebody was overweight, like Big Show or Samu, we'd send them down there to lose some weight. Or if somebody was being punished by Vince, they'd send them down there for a few months to work down there. And sometimes they would send talent down there to help them beef up their shows. Like the Acolytes went down there and beat the hell out of some of these guys to, quote, teach them respect. Bradshaw was brutal.
Mark Henry went down there. I felt kind of bad. He went down there and dropped a whole bunch of weight.
That was Mark Henry. Mark and Big Show were both sent down there to lose weight, which they did. Because Big Show was getting to be 500, 525 pounds, and that was too much. It wasn't healthy.
The bad thing is, Henry went out and dropped his weight, and Big Show didn't, and Show got the call back before Henry, so you kind of felt bad about that a little bit.
I don't know, but Big Show looks good now. I mean, I've seen him, and, you know, he's doing good with his weight.
No doubt about it. He definitely is great and better stick now, for sure. We covered a lot of territory right there. Any thoughts on WCW after you left with Eric coming in and the way how everything turned out?
Well, my wife still worked there. She was in the marketing department, so I really didn't do anything or say anything anti-WCW, although I wasn't really a big fan of what they were doing, and I really didn't like it once they started doing stuff with Hogan and Savage and all the ex-WWF guys, but I didn't really care because I didn't work there anymore. And when I was going to go up and work for WWF, I took the job, but before I actually moved up there, they gave me a month to work out my stuff in Atlanta, sell my place or whatever, and get ready. And so Bruce Pritchard came in and wanted to know where the WCW offices were. So I drove him to where the offices were and showed him. And then we came back to CNN Center, and took a tour of a CNN tour around the building and so forth. And this was all in preparation of the DX invasion that was going to happen the next day. So basically, one of my last little things in Atlanta was to help Bruce Pritchard lay out the invasion for DX to do, which to me is what turned everything around and got all the fans to start WWF. I really kind of felt like it.
There's no doubt about it. With the Mike Tyson publicity and everything, he definitely earned every dollar that he was refereeing the Stone Cold and Michael's match. And
WCW had beat WWF in the ratings, I think it was for 48 or 52 weeks or something like that, almost a year, and Vince was tired of losing, and Russo says it was his idea. I don't know. Russo seems to claim a lot of things, according to Dutch's newest book. But in any event, supposedly Vince Russo at a meeting told Vince, "I'm sick and tired of us losing every week." And see, the week that they really got clobbered, I think their ratings were like a two something, but nowadays that would be good, but for them back then it was terrible. And it was a show that was just absolutely horrible. It was a European tape done in Europe or something that nobody cared about. And some things were thrown at him as far as old school type ideas and you know, stuff to get back at Eric for doing like the things that they were, you know, they were attacking
Raw.
Yeah, and all those things,
stuff,
you know, Vince had never properly responded to. So this DX invasion was perfect, you know, especially when they would actually show up at WCW shows and get the fans all riled up yelling, you know, WWF or DX, DX or whatever, right outside a WCW show. So it was really cool.
I think the invasion helped. I also think another thing that really turned around is they got, like you said, people want personal things they can sink their teeth into. And by having Vince McMahon go from being lovable Vince McMahon announcer to evil, crooked politician, owner of WWE, who's going to do whatever it takes to run his company with, whether it has to do with screwing Bret Hart or Steve Austin or whoever. And that was, you know, by having that 20 years he had been in front of the camera doing that, and he turns, and then you got Austin who winds up turning face. It was just such a fantastic opportunity for the fans to get to see, because, I mean, who couldn't equate that? A lot of people, you know, they don't want to go to work, and a lot of people don't like their bosses, and it's like, you know, that guy's an a-hole. I'd like to see him stomp, and they can cheer for Austin to stomp McMahon, and it's just their boss sitting out there.
Yeah, that's what got it over, is that everybody could identify with giving your boss some crap, and so, you know, he got applauded by everybody. And around the same time is when The Rock started doing his thing and getting over, so the force of both of them showed the fans that things were changing. In fact, Vince really wanted The Rock to be a heel, and the fans wouldn't let him be a heel. They cheered him too much, so Vince let him be a babyface.
And to be honest, they didn't want when they tried to turn Austin as a heel. The fans didn't want that at all. They just spit all over that. No doubt about that.
Right. And at the WrestleMania 17, when that happened, that was the pay per view where we had the timing of that is when WWF finalized the purchase of WCW. And Jim Ross had been down there a dozen times to interview all the talent and decide who should talk to Vince to see who he wanted to bring up. I think there was only going to be a dozen or maybe 16 talents that he was going to retain. And So all of those 16 talents that he kept were all flown to Houston and sat in a press box watching WrestleMania from a press box. And I was the one designated to the host in the press box as the host of WWF. You know, here's what we do kind of thing. And it was catered with all kinds of goodies to eat and drink. And, you know, Stacy Keibler was the one female, and John Laurinaitis was in charge of the WCW wrestlers, and I don't remember all of them that were there off the top of my head, but Hugh Morris and most of them didn't make it. You know, they were all there and got tried out, and, you know, after a year or more, you know, most of them were already gone.
Do you think that they should have went ahead with their first plans to have a WCW show? I mean, it was going to be something like, I think Shane McMahon presents WCW or something, or do you feel that they made
that was one of the ideas that I thought would have worked, and they tried the invasion, which if they would have done it right, you know, or the company versus company would have been good, but they torpedoed it the same way Crockett did with the UWF. They didn't play it out right or let it develop the way it should have done. I mean, from the beginning, the WWF was totally the powerful one and the other guys the losers. I mean, by having Stephanie, supposedly, or Shane be the owners, and for them to go in against their father, to me, what was money, but they didn't do it the right way.
Well, even though they didn't do it, that the pay-per-view where the WWE took on the Alliance, that was actually one of the more successful pay-per-views they had at that time, I remember. Even though it screwed up so bad, imagine how much money they left on the table and where they would have been if they had done it right.
Right. And today the fans now don't even know about any of that. And the fans that were there then, most of them are gone. I mean, the fans that were hanging in there, I think, have mostly vanished.
Sure. I may have already. I can't remember if I already asked you. I think I went off. I missed it. And I apologize if I did. But I was going to say, how did you wind up going, okay, you're doing a magazine for WWE. How did you wind up getting involved with developmental on that?
Because I decided I just didn't want to work for Vince Russo anymore, and his assistant, who was a real bitch, and so I told Jim Ross that I'm not going to take it anymore. Can I transfer to your department? And so he found a way for that to happen. I took a pay cut to do it, but it was worthwhile.
A lot of people talk about the creative abilities of Vince Russo and stuff. You worked with the man and everything. I know Dutch Mantel, like you said, has had some things to say in his book. I know Jim Cornette has spoken volumes. You can Google that on the internet, whoever can, and find out what he thought of. What was your opinion of Russo, I guess, the creator or the creative mind, and Russo the person?
Russo in the magazine department was a tremendous editor and a guy who came up with good ideas for stories. Had no problems with that at all. I didn't work with him in the creative department, but I know him and Ed, can't remember the guy's name. There was a guy they brought up named Ed Farrar. Him and Ed worked together for a year or two before Vince left, before they left, and supposedly came up with a lot of stuff, but obviously Vince picked and chose what he wanted to use. And, I mean, if you come up with 25 ideas and Vince uses 5 of them, then you still came up with creative stuff. So I think at the time they were coming up with stuff that Vince liked and stuff that worked. But in TNA, it's, you know, we're seeing the same stuff recycled, basically. Plus, they were supposed to be wrestling and not all this backstage stuff. One of the things that Vince Russo's assistant told me, who was getting more and more power due to her, she was just a little girl from Stanford High School that knew nothing about the business, but because of him, she was now trying to boss me around. She quoted that Vince told her that one of these days we're not even going to need a wrestling ring, it's just going to be backstage stories.
Really?
And I thought that was just total BS, but sounds like, you know, that may be the way Vince is still trying to go. You know, Russo said that the wrestling matches were just an excuse for the wrestlers to be there, but that the matches themselves should not be the storylines. It should be what goes on backstage. So Vince always wanted, I mean, both of them wanted to do action adventure, not pro wrestling.
Okay, I can understand if someone's looking at, I guess, stepping out of where I'm at right now and saying, okay, I don't like wrestling. I like entertainment or movies or whatever. And, you know, I want to do more backstage stuff. I want to do more of this. But, I mean, really, wrestling is something that is so, when it's done right, it's one heck of an entertainment value,
right,
and also a sporting event. I mean, I think, I hate to say it, but when you're wrestling, you're competing with sports, entertainment, whatever, and even people who don't like wrestling, when wrestling's done good, I remember when I would be at a friend of mine's house, or I heard, well, no, it was a guy who I listened to being interviewed on the radio. It was people calling in talking about wrestling on WSB years ago, and said, and they made the comment that people talk about wrestling and say they don't like wrestling. No one admits to watching wrestling, but it gets these huge ratings, so you know so many people are watching it. Furthermore, if you sit somebody down in front of even who doesn't like wrestling, sooner or later, after so many matches, at least on the Superstation or something, they'll pick a favorite and start cheering for somebody based on what's going on in the match.
Right. And
so why would you limit yourself to competing with stuff like ER and Mike and Molly and The Middle and whatever else is on TV today, Modern Family?
I think because of the thing dating back since the 50s or 60s that, quote, wrestling is considered not top rank. It's more lower level. And so he wanted to do a product that he wouldn't have to say, you know, that it's wrestling. So he wanted, you know, that's what it was. I mean, we were banned from even using it. We were,
I was going to say, being
around
Vince McMahon, I know he's got the sports entertainment thing going, but did you ever get the feeling that he really looked down at pro wrestling or said anything about stuff in other territories or anything, or did he even watch anything in other territories?
He really didn't watch any of the others. It was up to, like in talent relations, we would watch tapes from ECW and Puerto Rico and indie tapes, but he really didn't want to hear any of the ideas. He just wanted to know if somebody could work good or look good. Basically, they were more interested in looks than working.
You're talking about cosmetically, their musculature, if they're physically fit or not.
Right. And, you know, if somebody was ugly or was a monster-looking kind of guy, he wasn't interested. He wanted... I mean, as you can see now, they're all so generically alike that you can't tell one from the other.
Yeah,
unless
you're a hardcore fan, I hate to say it, but, you know, people used to talk about, you know, I can't tell, you know, one of the natural, the naturals apart in TNA. Well, unless you're watching it a lot, I mean, you know, how many people can tell, you know, members of, you know, NXT or Trent Beretta or Kurt Hawkins.
Even the Even the girls, they to me, they're all look alike. You know, their hair, they're all hair is all the same. You know, nothing against them personally, but unless you watch every week, you don't really can't tell the difference. Whereas before, even the girls, each one had their own gimmick, their own style. You know, whether it was Trish or it was Lita or, you know, whatever, they were very different. The other thing is when Watts was in charge, the guys were not allowed to wear the same color tights or trunks, and he was against black tights because that's what everybody wore. So he told guys that when you come to TV, do not bring your black tights because he wanted to see different colors, not just black. And now I don't think there's any thought to that at all.
No, no. A lot of people look exactly the same. Oh, they, according to what I understand, they have signed Awesome Kong or Amazing Kong, who was in TNA, the big 200-plus pound monster.
Well,
WWE's got her, but I just wonder if they're going to use her in that monster role. And because they already got Gail Kim, I don't know what that is. I hadn't seen her on TV in months. Or
they haven't really.
Well, maybe
used.
They don't.
Gail is there, but they haven't really done much with her. Don't know why.
Never tomorrow, you never do know.
Right. Gail is a good worker and a good performer.
I was going to say, but with Awesome Kong, I'm wondering if they're going to use her as a monster and make her birth the Fae of this generation. You never can tell.
Well, it depends, I guess, on what happens in Florida and if she does what they ask her down there, and then eventually maybe they'll bring her up for a dark match. But what I would have her do, obviously, go in and brutalize the girls, and even two or three at a time. And I'm sure eventually Vince would have, you know, them gang up and beat her, you know, to get back over. But to me, that's what she would do with her, is use her to terrorize the girls. I mean,
just go in there and demolish about four of them, and
when
and
Jacqueline,
make her a monster. And
yeah, when Jackie Moore, who is not a monster, was in WCW, Jacqueline, she was such a tough wrestler that, plus they would have her beat up on guys, you know, at ringside after a match, she'd have her attack a guy, that for real, people believed that she not only could she beat any of the girls, but the guys better watch out too, because she's a tough little thing. And WWF never took advantage of that.
No, and I mean, really, they leave a lot on the table by not taking advantage of some stuff. And I mean, okay, I drive a Toyota Camry around. Okay, the wheels that I have on there, or the tires I have. Okay, they need to be changed every now and then, but I'm not going to go through here and try my damnedest to make rectangular tires or refuse to drive the car. I just don't understand why they do. But, you know, it's Vince's company. He can do certain things. Well, when you were in developmental and looking at that, what other things did you look for and everything? What is something that would make someone stand out to someone in developmental, to someone who's watching over developmental, right?
Well,
at the time when you were in
the students that were in OVW. I mean, there were four different groups at one time. There was Memphis, Louisville, Les Thatcher's group in Ohio, and then Puerto Rico. And I would say 95% of them were all had possibilities of being something that Vince should take a look at, and out of those, you know, maybe 5% would actually make it. No matter what we thought, it didn't really matter unless he liked the way they looked or the way they talked, which is fine, you know, it's his company. But a lot of talent that got looked at and not utilized, you know, have disappeared, and it's a shame because they could have really meant something. I mean, they were on WWF for a while, and then they just kind of disappeared. Can't think of the names offhand because there were so many.
I was going to say, to make it a little easier for you and everything, do you recall any stars that really you thought, this guy has got it, this guy's going to make it, and for whatever reason didn't?
Yeah, a couple that I can think of off the top of my head were like Rico Constantino. I don't know if you know who he was. He was a big star in OVW.
Sure,
and his gimmick, he had a really tremendous finish where he did some kind of spin off the top rope and won. And in real life, he had been a policeman and had been shot in the line of duty and had
former
a fantastic
American Gladiator.
Yeah, fantastic background. And unfortunately, he was coming to the business in his 30s, and Vince thought he was too old to start doing something with.
They brought him up for a little bit. It had him as the manager of Jamal and Rosie, the 3-Minute Warning.
Yeah.
And then they had him as an Adrian Street to do something very similar to Adrian Street with Jackie Gata. And that was it, more or less, for him.
Yeah, he didn't get much of a thing. And then another one was that guy from Louisiana that was the Third Road Warrior. Don't remember his name offhand, but he was, you know, when Hawk wasn't able to work and they made him Animal's partner, the other Road Warrior.
Darren Rosdoff?
No, it wasn't Darren. It was a guy from OVW, a big guy who I think he had played in the XFL. He played, I think, for the L.A. team, and he was the first guy to score a touchdown in the XFL. But anyway, they tried him as a worker and a big bruiser-type guy, and they didn't use.
Ooh,
but,
was he real tall, or?
Yeah, big tall. John Heidenreich,
okay.
Right. To me, he was a natural. Like I said, viciously, his look was like of a monster. You know, he would look at you, and he would look like like he could be a killer.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel he didn't wind up making it for whatever reason?
I really don't know. I mean, you never know, because it could be something that happened backstage where, you know, they said the wrong thing to the wrong person, or you just never know.
How often does that happen? How often does something we see on TV, the result of someone, you know, sitting in someone else's chair or upgrading to first class or not doing what they should or saying the wrong thing to an agent? How often did that happen? I'm not asking for specific things, but if you want to share, you're more than welcome to. But,
it probably used to happen quite a bit, and now the guys are more structured. And since there's only one company really to work for, as soon as they come in, they're probably told what the rules are. But back then, you had to learn by experience. And Bradshaw was always one of the enforcers of making sure the guys followed the rules.
Yeah, he was a pretty bad dude right there. And I tell you, just on commentary, you could tell that he just could not stand Mizanin, the Miz, when he first came up there. Just the way he talked, and he sounded like he had just no respect for this man.
That's his book tells some interesting stories, and then I've observed quite a few more stories or situations where John would do things that I would consider hazing or making somebody show their respect, but, you know, that's the way the business is or was, you know.
Hazing and wrestling? Come on! Oh, man.
You know, things that if he wasn't Bradshaw, he would have been fired, but because he was John Bradshaw and Vince thought what he did was amusing, he didn't get fired.
Well, the people talk about, well, you know, if Vince don't like you, you're in trouble. I guess Bradshaw is one who Vince really liked that wasn't in trouble and everything. Is
I never got in trouble. I don't think Bradshaw was ever in trouble.
Any interesting stories of anything that happened in developmental you can share with us or anything like that? Any humor stories or anything like that?
Well, on one time, Percy was not working the road anymore and was still getting paid by the company, so they were coming up with something for him to do. And so they put him as a helper for me to go to Memphis and write up a report for JR on how the different talent was looking. So we went down there, and the Acolytes were sent down there to work a show, and they were against Lance Cade and what's his name? He's in TNA right now. What's X's name? I'll think of it in a minute. His name was Spanky. His gimmick name was Spanky. In any event, they were against the Acolytes. And Bradshaw hit Lance Cade in the head with a steel chair so hard that it was the hardest chair shot I'd ever seen. And he was squirting blood all over the place. And afterwards, Lance, you know, went back and thanked him for the match as he's supposed to do. And I said to John, what was the deal? Why'd you hit him so hard? And he goes, well, he's got to learn to respect, you know, that this ain't bullshit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
When that tag team that was so over in ECW, they're both passed away now.
Public Enemy, Ted Petty, and Mike Durham, Rocco Rock, Johnny Grunge.
When Public Enemy came into WWF at their first TV taping, and I think this came from Vince to make him show some respect, Bradshaw just beat the holy crap out of both of them. I don't even know if the match aired on TV. It was so brutal.
It was a brutal match. I remember seeing it. I think it did air and everything, but it was something else, no doubt about it.
I don't hold any of that against Bradshaw. You know, that's John, and you know what he thought was important, and that's the way the business used to be. So I don't hold it against.
Do you feel that, you know, McMahon, by him not doing anything, agree with Bradshaw's the way how he carried on, or
I think the blind eye, plus I think he was even encouraged to see how much they could take or if they would quit or not. I think that was the thing, let's see if they quit or not.
Interesting. I was going to say, you mentioned Memphis earlier as a developmental area. Interesting thing. I know that some people had mentioned Steve Bradley. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah.
And a lot of people predicted he'd be one of the next big stars.
Steve Bradley should have been a big star. I have good memories of him, and he was a good worker and did everything he could. One thing he kept doing that would turn Vince off and tell him that they'd have to change it and keep working on it.
Do what?
Excuse me. His gimmick, he'd call himself the Memphis Mofo or the Big Mofo or something like that. And Vince hated that. He needs to change his gimmick. And so Steve never really got called up.
Mm.
No, Steve unfortunately never got a chance. One of the things basically reminding me, Steve, that reminds me of is that I was allowed to go to one of the Brian Pillman Memorial events that Les Thatcher threw, and a bunch of WWE talent went down there, and Brian Pillman's widow was there with his kids and a lot of people from different territories that knew Brian. So it was really a really nice event to go to. And Steve was one of those guys. I've got something in my throat. So that was pretty cool. And that's the last time I've seen or heard about Brian's family, but hope they're okay. There was a little Brian Pillman Jr. Wonder how that little kid's doing.
No idea. That's just a very good question. That's a very good question.
They really didn't know who their daddy was.
No, it's a sadly. Lacey Von Erich didn't know Carrie either, too.
I knew of Lacey when she was just like a little 1 or 2 year old. You know, that's when I saw her at World Class. She was just a little baby, basically.
No, she's in TNA. Wow.
Well, I think she's gone now. I think she quit.
Well, she was recently, yeah.
Gorgeous, gorgeous woman. Vince, I mean, I don't know how she messed up. She was in Florida for a while training, and then somehow they let her go. I have no idea why.
I know that Lexi Pillman a few years ago may have worked some shows here in the Georgia area for a promotion out of, I think, Jasper or Elijah, but I'm not familiar. I didn't never see her.
Well, probably trying to make some money, and nothing against that, but really she had never worked any ringside or any matches, or really was never at any shows, and so she really couldn't have known that much about anything as far as the business. Brian, she never came to any tapings or anything.
Absolutely. What else is there? Any thoughts of the Mean Street on the Mean Street Posse? I know they were down there in developmental. I thought that it was underrated. It may not have been the best wrestling, but one of my guilty pleasures of the Attitude Era was seeing Patterson and Briscoe against the Mean Street Posse. And I actually think they should have put the belts on Patterson and Briscoe for a while.
I thought Patterson and Briscoe were money. I loved seeing that gimmick. And the Mean Street Posse were tremendous, and, yeah, they were in developmental, and Rodney had done really good as far as losing weight and shaping his body up. He actually got turned into he made his physique V-shaped and had a good chest and good muscles. And the other kid, beside Rodney, who was the other guy?
Pete Gass and Joey Abs was the kick. Was the Southern version from Southern?
Yeah, Pete Gass had done really good. I mean, they really got their wrestling down and were doing a good job. And believe it or not, when they decided to shut Memphis down and merge those guys and split them up between Thatcher and Cornette, and my job was to fly to Memphis with a list of who the company wanted to keep and who they didn't want to keep. And it was my job to let them know who was going to be kept. It was an absolutely horrible trip. I had to write up all their names and remember what their real names were versus their gimmick names so I could talk to them seriously. And had to let most of them go, including the Main Street Posse. And Shane didn't know anything about it and knew about it after it had already happened. And, back at the office, he grilled me about it. And I said, I'm just doing what JR said for me to do, and this came from your dad. And so, I'm just doing my job. And he was pissed. But anyway, I let a lot of those talent go. And one of the ones I didn't let go that was going to be kept was Lisa Marie Verone, which is Victoria. And
sure.
since I was called, I wanted to talk to each one personally and not as a group. So we were seeing them in alphabetical order. And Verone meant she was the very last one. So she had to sit there for like over an hour waiting for her turn. And by the time she got in, and I told her that, I told her right off the bat without her having to wait that she was being retained and that she was going to be assigned to Louisville. And she gave me a big hug, which I was real happy to get. And, But it was so hard letting these kids go. I mean, that was one of the things I didn't like to do. I had to do two other firings for JR. I had to fire Percy once, and I had to fire Bobby Eaton, which I absolutely hated because Bobby had always been a real hero of mine, and Percy had always been a friend. But neither one of them held it against me. They knew it was business and it was the company. But I did not enjoy those at all.
I can imagine it's going to be difficult to be able to do that, for sure. Real quick, one last question. Anybody who made it that kind of surprised you, that made it bigger than what you thought they would?
Well,
Not trying to get you in a ton of trouble either, but just...
Well, when Cena was first brought up and really was a baby and knew nothing, I told him that one day you're going to be as big, if not bigger, than Stone Cold. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah, I'm sure. And he goes, well, your mouth to God's ears, we'll see. And I'm sure he is making much more than Steve in merchandise, even though Steve sold a ton. And I'm sure he's a millionaire off of just merchandise.
No doubt about it. I'd happily take his merchandise check for a week. Happily,
right, and then DVD royalties and movie stuff, so good for him. He's a good kid, never did any drugs, never was in any trouble, and always an excellent student, so good for him.
Good deal. Dane, you got any other quick questions for Mr. Brent as the time ticks down?
No, sir.
I was going to say that I really do appreciate you coming out. I do want to let people know that I know you currently got a couple of some projects you're working on. Would you let the folks know some stuff you're working on down the line?
I got a couple of different book projects, and I'll let you know about those down the road. And also a website or a Facebook page or whatever associated with them where they can get more information, but I don't have that right now at this moment. But, you know, the books will be good. They'll be full of stories of stuff that you hadn't heard about. You know, I'm not a wrestler, but I was backstage for so many things and saw so many things that have a ton of stories.
Well, we really have enjoyed you tonight, I tell you. We went almost, I got about a minute left, and we went up right now and enjoyed all your stories, and we just hit the high marks. So, we'd love to have you back sometime. Would that be possible, sir?
Well, I appreciate it, David. I love to do it. I really enjoyed being in Georgia and got to understand a lot about Georgia wrestling, so I encourage, you know, what you're doing.
Thank you, sir, very much. While you're mentioning that, again, tomorrow night, Ringside Wrap with Rich Tate, Mike Supervivi, and Les Thatcher, 8 o'clock on the Georgia Wrestling History Radio Network. I want to thank again Dennis Brent, my guest tonight. And I want to thank Mark Danger, my co-host. Again, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week. Stephen Platinum is our guest. And we're out of here for another episode, the first one of the new year, of the Day of the Day.
Say hello to Les for me.
Sure will, absolutely. Remember, again, we appreciate you doing the show. We'll definitely say hello to him, and we're out of here. Have a great 2011. Happy New Year, everybody.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.